Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the roundtable and webinar on real estate and structured funds finance, fundraising and fund investments, innovative and emerging structures. This event is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates in association with the Indian Private Equity and Venture Capital Association and Asia Pacific Real Estate Association. The speakers are Masatoshi Matsuo, President and Chief Executive Officer for Genkai Capital Management Company Limited; Karan Bularia, Head of Godrej Fund Management Private Limited; Mr. Joshikura, Partner for Private Equity and M&A from Nishit Desai Associates; Ruchir Sinha, Co-Head Private Equity and M&A from Nishit Desai Associates; and Mr. Vyapak Desai, Partner for Securities and International Commercial Dispute Resolution Practices from Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of today's discussion. If you should need assistance during the call, listen for an operator by pressing star and zero on your touchtone telephone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS device, Play Store for Android, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand over the session to Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Yeah, thanks a lot. And thanks a lot for everyone here to join this webinar and the roundtable. And I guess it so happened that it became, of course, this was planned a little early, but some of the announcements made by the government recently, not only that, they were some of the announcements, I must say, they are path-breaking announcements, particularly overall for the FDI sector, more particularly real estate. So I think that made this conference the webinar even more appropriate in these times. So without taking too much time on the general introduction, which I guess everyone knows in terms of the speakers here, maybe we can start the discussions here. And you know, to start with, let me first go to Matsuo-san. I think he's the president and the CEO of Genkai Capital Management, a Japanese firm. And I just wanted to, you know your thoughts as to, let's say, why you are in India. What are your thought processes compared to other jurisdictions when it comes to particularly the real estate sector? Because we have not seen many Japanese investors in the past looking at India, particularly for real estate sector. We have seen it for various other industries. So maybe you can give a little more broader picture in terms of how you look at India real estate sector and what are your thought process in terms of strategies in investments and what you expect from India and government going forward. Okay.
Hi, my name is Masatoshi Matsuo from Genkai Capital. My company is a real estate fund management company with the Japanese institution behind us, 10 years old. Now we run around $2 billion plus US dollar assets under management. So far, our company is managing the Japanese fund, Japanese institutional money and investing only into direct real estate only in Japan. Japanese, as you might know, market is very saturated and the cost of capital is so low. Many of you may know, but the government bond 10 years only yielding 0.3%. It's very, very different from your country. It's almost nothing. Yes, it's a lot. I don't know why our company has so much, our country has so much capital and nowhere to go. It's a kind of sad situation. Because of this kind of a cultural and also communication barrier, we are not so good at investing outside of the country so far. So for us, it's a challenge, but our thought process is like we are doing a lot of our investment in real estate in Japan and yielding you know, good office building, 50%, 100%, and trying to gearing up up to 80%, and trying to make it like 5%, 6%, and betting on this upside capital gain or loss. It's a very, very risky game, but we're so used to it. We're taking so much of risk in that direction, but we're not kind of ignoring the opportunity outside the country. Our country is maybe same today, India, 40 years ago. 1970, people were buying real estate, buying a house without no doubt. Even the cost of capital is 7% at the time, but everybody's jumping on to buying the house. You know, my grandmother telling me, once you get the job, just buy a house, borrow money, buy a house. That's the normal way of thinking. But the market has changed after bubble burst, and people are not thinking that way. But still, we're hanging on to the same old myth of a land. So I want to change that kind of way of thinking for institutional investors to look outside. And this country is just in a good timing for the economic growth. And more interesting part is this country has a very interesting financial policy, which try not to see the bubbling situation of real estate. So capital is very restricted. So I see this is very interesting opportunity for us to bring in more patient, cheap cost of capital money. Yes, there are so many risks, which these guys are going to tell us later, but handling these risks, and I think this is our mission, to bring this patient long-term capital to place this country. We're not just a hedge fund, so we don't need to bring the money back in 3 years with 20% IR. We are at the play, let me longer-term investment. It's a challenge, but for thinking about this kind of a situation, I think this is our opportunity and also our mission to do this kind of long-term investment in this country. That's why we're here. But as you know, I mean, we're beginners, and so we're learning a lot of things. It's, yes, a lot of headaches, but I'm very optimistic about this opportunity. I'd like to take a risk, and I'd like to show our project to the investor and see how we can grow from there. I think opportunity is so big and we can do so many things. That's my
question. So obviously we have not heard a lot of praises for the restrictions that Indian government puts in. possibly this is one dimension to it. And that was possibly one reason that India also faced the economic crisis little better than the other jurisdictions, but of course this is particularly a new dimension that we'll see as to how the Japanese funds and the market looks at India. Going to Karan, as you would know, he's the head of Godrej Fund Management. It's one of the first successful real estate platform with APG, and I think in the last 3 years you have done a very, very successful fundraise, particularly on the residential real estate market. So what is your thought process and what are your views when it comes to driving of these investments through these platforms? How would you see these platforms working compared to funds generally coming directly without a local joint venture or other structures that are available? So what are your views and what is your experience when it comes to such platforms, and how have you done it successfully in the last 3 years?
Yeah, so I guess from our perspective, we started in the reverse manner than what other fund managers did. We went bottom up instead of going top down. So our first structure was a platform structure that we worked with Nishit Sai to come up with. At the time, that was quite innovative, and then people wanted to get involved in a platform type structure. But the journey for us is actually quite different. We are now innovating again with structures where we are going more towards a pure play real estate fund structure, where we manage the investors and we discharge the fiduciary duties to them, and therefore we become a full manager. So the reason actually we can do this is because we had an unhindered look into the entire operating business that we run, which is Pan India, and that really taught us where the mistakes happen, where the problems occur, whether it's approvals process, whether it's the costing that goes into the developments of residential units, or whether it is the timing, the time lag, all of those things we thought we got a superior view on. Because rather than there be a developer and a manager, and the manager is kind of second-guessing the developer, we had the full access to it. So what that did for us really is that it allowed us to change the way we underwrite projects. I think that is different from any other manager that exists today in the country. And when we underwrite, we are able to rethink price risk correctly, so therefore drive up risk-adjusted returns. Our investors thought that the first round was a winning strategy. We also went and spent a lot of time taking the Godrej philosophy of very high corporate governance and highest levels of transparency, and we morphed it into a fund management business. So now what happens is that investors who want to work with us, they're much more confident. More people want to come out and join our sort of fund management program. So we're able to innovate again and actually go more towards the fund structure and actually get away from the club type structure that we actually started with. And of course, we work with Nishit Sai here to continue to build those structures.
Sure. So maybe I'll come back to you with maybe a little more specific or a particular example or an experience that you may be able to share. But before that, maybe Ruchir, if I come to you. In last 10 years, I think we have seen several different structures when it comes to real estate investments, right from simple equity to debt to NCDs, some of the in the listed space and otherwise. So how do you see whether these structures have now matured? It's more, I would say, taken a shape where most of the things are happening in a particular manner, or there are still innovations which are seen in the market, because real estate is a very different asset when it comes to investments and the exits. Also with the recent changes which I guess everyone is now looking at, particularly generally under the FDI route, where a lot of different structures are not possible, and particularly real estate where a lot of liberalization has happened in terms of specific requirements and exit requirements. How do you see the past structures playing going forward with the new law? And what are the new innovations that you see which will bring, another spree of excitement in this sector?
Sure. No, I think obviously these are very extremely interesting times. Real estate opened up in 2005, and in about these 10 years, I think we have seen a complete cycle. Move from pure equity to preferred equity to structured debt to pure debt, and now in the past, I would say, in the course of the past year, a resurgence towards again pure equity. So I think it's been a whole cycle which has come up. I think the way I see the market shaping up, at least in the current times, is that debt obviously remains the flavor for SPV level. Reason is, in most cases in residential, etc., it's self-liquidating asset, there's constant income upstreaming required, but obviously becomes more tax optimized when you push in debt. The other reason for debt popularity was always that, real estate is not like innovative tech, which gives you 45, 50, 70% returns, right? Debt, at the end of it, if at all it did really well, kind of gave you about 20% optimized return. So, that's what real estate gave, and those were debt-like returns. And at the end of it, it was asset-backed or hard asset-backed. So, stabilized assets or real assets have their own means and mechanisms of investment, and people preferred that there should be some kind of security creation also, which should exist, which was not there, which was not possible in pure equity-like structures of 2005 with equity and instruments compulsorily converted put into equity. So I think there were many reasons from tax perspective, commercial perspective, security creation, many of that reasons, which kind of drove the structures towards debt. and that kind of drove the entire cycle, and I think we'll be covering on structured bonds, a listed NCD, which we pioneered. You know, Anishal and I personally did, you know, the first few deals in that, which became the market standard, and about 75% of the offshore capital that came in the course of last year was structured by way of listed bonds. So that really became the flavor. Now, slowly, because there has been so much of debt which, you know, which kept coming in, and obviously there was a mushrooming of you know, domestic debt, the NBFCs, you know, and all large LPs setting up, you know, domestic NBFCs because, you know, there was a need for onshore debt, that ultimately there was a huge scrambling for players, a lot of capital chasing very few people. And over the course of time, what also happened is that the spreads kept becoming thinner, you know. So, and somewhere down the line, all of a sudden, we saw a burst. I mean, Karan, your platform was probably one of those few places where, you know, large funds like APG and others said, you know, we repose faith in large developers, we want equity-like returns, and they put that money in. And then, you know, we worked on on other deals, you know, the Goldman Piramal example is one, and there are many others, which kind of saw the trend changing towards taking equity risk with larger developers having substantial track record. So the situation changed from dead deals towards pure equity, and these deals, if you see the past trend, these are entity level deals. Like the Goldman Piramal deal is not an asset level deal. It's an entity level deal where you're reposing faith in the brand. And that kind of track record. So I think that kind of trend is likely to continue with the larger developers. And obviously for the bigger players, there's obviously no challenge for capital. For the smaller guys, I think that will still remain the way it is. And just while we were on the angle of unfolding equity and the resurgence of equity, I think the time couldn't have been more opportune for the government on this Diwali to open up the entire FDI or the foreign direct investment policy for real estate. And I think all of you might have seen it, but in your bags, which you have, there is this hotline, it's called the Real Estate Update, where we've analyzed all these amendments and all the changes. So I will cover some of them, and some of them will be covered by Nishal, but I think there are three or four major changes which they've made. You know, the first is on the minimum area. So earlier we used to have a 50,000 square meter built-up area restriction in Press Note 2, 2005. That got reduced to Press Note, that got reduced to 20,000 square meters. And now that area has been totally been done away with. So now you can actually have situations. Some people feel it is too good and probably a little aggressive, but I think good is better. For because now every project can, every small project, respect to the size, can avail of foreign direct investments. So there's no area restriction. So in your small bungalow or in your small parcel in the heart of the city, you know, you can have foreign direct investment. And I think that was pretty important, because even when, you know, we were reducing it to 2005, and at a policy level, we had recommended that this 50,000 never made sense, because in heart of the city projects like, you know, Bombay or Delhi, you didn't have 50,000. And where you have 50,000, like in tier 2 cities or maybe certain far off areas, if investors didn't want to invest. So I think the area restriction is one of the major changes, which is likely to accentuate foreign investment. The other is on the minimum capitalization. There was a $5 million which was brought in. It was earlier $10 million, and now it was reduced to $5 million in this Press Note 10 of 2014. That $5 million has also been reduced to nil. But you know, the benefit of $5 million going, or the minimum capitalization going, is not $5 million really. I mean, the kind of people or the kind of foreign investment that was coming in wasn't really that much concern about $5 million, because most of them invested more than that. It was the timing. It was the challenge was in the language in Press Note 10, which said that minimum capitalization must be brought in within 6 months of commencement of the project. And commencement of the project was in first time in Press Note 10, defined to mean the sanction plans. So if you did not get your $5 million within 6 months from commencement of the project, that was pretty early stage, you were in effect ineligible to receive foreign investment for the rest of your time without regulatory approval. Now that became a huge challenge, and at a policy level, and obviously informally, we did check with FIPB, and those approvals were pretty forthcoming. They said it will be forthcoming, though we didn't apply for it. But conceptually, people felt that this was an unnecessary shackle in achieving, in receiving foreign investment, because 6 months from sanction plans was a very short time. And many times foreign investors wanted to make late stage kind of investments. Commencement of project was a new definition, by the way, that the press note 10 added. Press note 2 of 2005, the original press note talked about a concept of commencement of business. And commencement of business was, in many ways and many written documents, understood by the DIPB, and they've told us written form that commencement of business really meant the date on which the first tranche of foreign investment came and or when you entered into the foreign investment agreement. So the parameter was that 6 months from the time when foreign investment came in, and you could keep on receiving foreign investment until the time you were in construction development, right? That parameter was then changed to commencement of project in press note 10, which linked it back to sanctioned plans. Now the challenge is, we don't know, we haven't seen the final print, this is still in press release form, we don't know in which form will the final draft come out. Because if the final draft does not incorporate the terms of commencement of project or until what time you can bring in, we might retrogress to the situation of press note 2, where you then could say that, you can bring in foreign investment till any stage until it is construction development, which then brings you to a question on when is the project, or until when can you say a project is in construction development. The view that many people then took was it was until you received the occupation certificate. That was as grey as you could get. So now, let's see how this is worded, but there has to be some parameter that you should say that could determine whether the project is still in construction development or not. And if it does not define any parameter, then technically, and I will draw the reference from the REIT regulations, which define a project to be completed only once you receive an occupation certificate. So that's one bit on the minimum capitalization. I think the third important change is from the perspective of the... So the third important change is, I think, from the perspective of opening up of the completed asset portfolio. I think we all know we tried very hard for the REITs to come in. And when we were pushing in for the REIT regime, I don't know Neetu is here or not, but through APRIA we made a lot of recommendations, met with SEBI and those discussions. But ultimately when the REIT regime came up, because of tax challenges and because of certain commercial challenges, the REIT regime never took off. For those of you who are interested in this book, Yellow Book, you have a section B which has several articles on REITs and the challenges why it didn't take off. But one of the challenges was, apart from REIT regime, was that why did we bring in the REIT regime? Was that we wanted to allow for monetization of stabilized yield generating assets. And in the FDI regime, there are two challenges that restricted or precluded foreign investment into completed assets. The first challenge came in from what we call as the capital account transaction regulation, which is the mother regulation for all foreign direct investment, which is foreign direct investment, foreign portfolio investment, foreign venture capital, and RI. Those capital account transactions prohibited any kind of foreign investment in any form in what we call as real estate business. And real estate business did not mean anything, it just excluded. It excluded construction development and bridges and things like that. So we did not allow real estate business, it was a prohibited category. And the other was obviously from an FDI policy perspective. The mindset always was that, the money should come into construction development, money should not come towards what we call a speculative capital, but towards developmental capital. So if you're getting in a foreign investor, let's develop something, create some value. And there I think the concept was always this, that if you are investing into a commercial real estate asset like a shopping mall or any other stabilized asset like a business center or an office complex, the concept was that this is not speculative. It is not speculative because you are rendering a service. When you are running a mall, you are not just earning lease rental income, you are providing many services, you are giving lift, you are providing security, you are providing all the infrastructure around it. This is just like you are running a hotel. Right, so it would be incorrect to say that merely because I'm earning lease rental income, that, you know, I become real estate business and my entire nature of my investment gets shrouded as a concept of speculative activity. So I think that was a concept that, you know, we got discussing, and the MOF was quite keen at that point in time to allow for investment into commercial real estate asset, and I think that is what is crystallized in this press note. The press note 10 of 2014 did lay some kind of inklings or indications that they will allow into operation and maintenance, that they will allow for investment into companies that were engaged in operation and maintenance of real estate assets, of stabilized yield generating real estate assets. But now this press note makes it very, very clear that earning of lease rental income will not amount to real estate business, and you would be allowed to invest into completed assets in terms of shopping malls, business centers, and township. But while this is a very progressive press note, I think two things must be kept in mind. One is the spirit of the law. The spirit is not that you come and just and that's the way we look at it, and that you just come and it's a pure speculative activity. The concept of opening it up, and I can say that because we were involved in some of these discussions, I think the concept of opening it up is that you're rendering some amount of service. So pure play rental activities, or pure play lease rental activities where you're only involved in lease rental and no operation maintenance will still be a questionable act. Let's see how the final print turns out, but I think those, I think, are some of the critical aspects. Happy to answer on the questions later on.
May I just sort of interject here? So what I wanted to say, and what I want to ask Nishal and Rochelle both, right, is from a fund manager's perspective, when we go and use the different consultants and advisors and we create a structure and we go and show it to an investor who is an institutional investor overseas and they're used to best-in-class practices, oftentimes that structure is subject to different type of interpretations, 6 or 7 different ways, right? Now, has it become better? It has become, you know, quite better, but it's never black and white still. You know, we still struggle with that. So I guess question to you guys is, what's the journey for it to go further and become black and white? Because we see some government bodies becoming really good with it. So what is there a role for the law firms, a role for the advisors? How do we get to that point where you can put a structure down a table and it's black-white, we know capital gains, we know service taxes exist in those particular ways, and everything is not sort of open to multiple levels of regulation?
Yeah, no, I think that's a more esoteric but a very practical question. I think in India, probably the approach should be that don't just go by what's written in law, because no matter what legal opinions anyone, me or any other law firm gives you, if regulatory action has to come, it will come. So rather than taking legal opinions and reading the law by the letter of it, I think let's understand the spirit. Each one of us and many others, you know, should use our offices and connects with the regulators to understand what's the spirit. And I think implement it in that spirit. Obviously, back it up with legal opinions and everything, but I think the spirit becomes more important. What Modi government is also proposing is a supra-appellate tribunal. So currently, RBI and the regulators behave in a very discretionary, arbitrary way, which is no appeal. You never appeal against an RBI decision in the Supreme Court, even though you technically can. But there is a concept paper which should be implemented soon, which will talk about the establishment of a supra-appellate tribunal wherein all appeals of RBI and other bodies can be heard by a quasi-judicial body, so there can be some hearing at the end of it.
I think as advisors, we follow one principle, that anything that we suggest, if tomorrow it is on the first page of Economic Times, will we be able to defend it or not? And that's the principle we follow, and that takes care of both the letter and spirit. But just to add to what Rochelle said, there are a couple of other amendments in the press release which came out, and path-breaking amendments, especially for non-resident Indians. Traditionally, if you see, the government has always given a preferential treatment to non-resident Indians, and that's why the NRI regime was specifically carved out from all the foreign investment regimes. But the NRIs over a period of time started getting a treatment which was not envisaged earlier. So if you see, all the investments by NRIs are allowed only directly. So only if the NRI directly invests in the Indian company or in the Indian property, the benefit of the NRI regime is available. The problem with this treatment was that most of the NRIs live in countries which do not have a great tax treaty with India. So for example, a US-based NRI wants to invest under the NRI route or as an NRI under the FDI route. The problem was that there is no capital gains tax exemption between the US and in the India-US tax treaty. Similarly, the same thing for the NRIs from UK and some of the other developed jurisdictions. So there was no flexibility which was available with the NRI community to pool in their money in an intermediate vehicle, which is what all the funds do, where you pool in money from LPs in one jurisdiction which has good tax treaty network with India, and then you take benefit of the treaty between that jurisdiction and India. So that was not something that was available with the NRI community. And that was a huge problem because it was actually impacting the IRRs for the NRIs when the money used to ultimately reach them, because it used to go through a number of layers of taxes in between. Second issue which NRI community was facing and which has still not been resolved is the government still doesn't allow NRI community to invest in listed bonds, which is something which is available for other types of investors. So this is one case where the government has given an unfair treatment to NRIs versus the non-NRIs. What the press release has done is the government has at least addressed the first issue, where NRIs are now allowed to invest through pooling vehicles. So NRIs can pool their money in a jurisdiction which has a good tax treaty network with India, and you can invest in the Indian real estate companies. The second advantage which government gave to Press Note 7 of 2015 is that all the investments which come through the on a non-repatriable basis, which is through the NRO account of the NRIs in India, will be treated as domestic investment. Now, this is a huge relief because a lot of conditions which apply to NRIs investing on a repatriable basis do not apply to NRIs investing on a non-repatriable basis, because this is considered a domestic investment. So your sectoral caps, your other conditions, pricing restrictions, all these restrictions don't apply when NRIs invest through the NRO from their NRO account. So this is something which has been a big relief, and in a way we have gone back to the, you know, there was a concept of overseas corporate body which was withdrawn by the government on September 16, 2003. But again, after 12 years, you know, we are back to the same regime, and which is a big plus as far as the NRI investments in India is concerned. The second big change which happened, which has been announced in the press release, is that foreign investment in LLPs will be under automatic route instead of approval route. Now this is something LLP, there are more and more businesses which want to use LLP as a structure as compared to company, because typically in real estate type of businesses where the income is typically upstreamed to the investor rather than you looking at an IPO of the project company. In those type of situations, when you upstream cash, there is a dividend distribution tax which has to be paid in a corporate structure, which is why the LLP structure was coming very handy, because any distribution by an LLP to the partner does not require, there is no dividend distribution tax that needs to be paid. But the problem with the foreign investment policy is, even though foreign investment in an LLP has been made brought under automatic route, there is one condition, that if that sector has any performance link condition, then foreign investment in that particular sector for LLP will not be allowed. Problem with real estate sector is the foreign investment has certain performance link conditions, like lock-in is there, which is a performance link condition, which means foreign investment in an LLP which conducts real estate construction development or real estate completed asset type of venture is not allowed as of today. So I think LLP as an option is not there. Hopefully it should open up. I don't see any reason why they have not allowed foreign investment in a real estate LLP, because this is the sector which requires maximum number of LLPs as compared to any other sector. So that's another big change which is there. The couple of other major changes which have come, and this is something which is a big plus in the press release, is on the lock-in restrictions. If you see the way the lock-in has worked right from the first press note in 2005. Earlier there was a lock-in, and government has changed the stance at least 6 to 7 times in the last 10 years. It started with lock-in for 3 years for minimum capitalization of $5 million. Then the government changed its stand to say that it's not only $5 million, the entire investment will be locked in for a period of 3 years from the date of investment. That stand again changed, where the government said the 3 years will not be calculated from the date of initial investment, but from the date of each tranche of investment. So if you have done a last mile funding for a project, then even after the project is over, the cash is sitting in the SPV. You still can't exit because you have to wait for 3 years for the last tranche which came into the project SPV. Then they again changed the law to say, which was through Press Note 10 of 2014, where they said that forget about 3 year lock-in. The problem is that most of the projects are not getting completed and foreign investors are exiting. So let me withdraw the 3 year lock-in condition. You can now exit only if the entire project is completed or upon completion of trunk infrastructure. Now this came as a huge setback for the foreign investors because lot of them were sitting on the investment for more than 3 years. The project was not complete because of various reasons which we all know in India, approvals don't come on time, markets are not good at times. So because of all these issues, the project was not completed and trunk infrastructure also takes its own time. So a lot of these deals got stuck since 2014, and you know, in the last 9 months there have been so many applications which FIBB has received just for exit because 3 years have lapsed but the project has not completed. The big reprieve which has come under the new press release is now that three year has been introduced again, and what the new press release says is that the exit can happen if 3 years have got completed or even before if your project has got completed or you have built a trunk infrastructure. So it's best of all the worlds in the last 10 years which the new press release has got, and this is again going to significantly help you know, the exits for the foreign investors. One of the other major change which has been brought is earlier non-resident to non-resident transfer during the lock-in period was not permitted without FIBB approval. And if you all recollect, there was a famous case of DE Shaw and 2i Capital which was an FEC, which was only one of the first FECIs that was registered. And the problem there was that they wanted to transfer the stake before 3 years. And the stand that was taken is that there is no repatriation of money happening outside India before 3 years because it's an NR to NR transfer. Everything is happening outside India. So there should not be any requirement for lock-in for a period of 3 years. But DIPP clearly together with FIBB gave a view that not only the repatriation outside India, but you cannot exit also before 3 years. And which is where all NR to NR transfers also view was established in the market that you can't exit before 3 years. The new press release clearly says that even before 3 years or before project completion or before completion of trunk infrastructure, you can transfer your stake to another non-resident. Now again, this is again a big positive as far as the foreign investment in real estate is concerned, because a lot of times the project needs money, but the same foreign investor is not able to give much because of various reasons, like, you know, the investment period for the fund may have got over, or the foreign investor may not be interested to further invest. In those situations, if there is another foreign investor who is willing to take a call on the project and invest further, the foreign investment can be transferred without FIBB. The investment can be transferred without FIBB approval to another non-resident investor. Another issue which used to come up earlier was if there is an NR to NR transfer, then would the 3 year lock-in again restart for the new NR? So let's say the NR had invested in 2013 and it transferred to another NR in 2015 after the 3 year lock-in got over. Would this 3 year restart for the new NR, no, new non-resident? I think there again, although we'll have to see the fine print, but at least the press release is quite clear that within the lock-in period, NR to NR transfer is allowed, which indirectly also suggests that the lock-in which was earlier applicable more at investor level now is applicable to the investment. So the new NR will only be subject to the residual lock-in rather than a fresh lock-in. So I think broadly these are the major changes which we have seen, coupled with what Ruchel said on the press release and the
sure. Questions. Sure. No, I think
we'll take questions.
Heard Karan on the experience on the investment platforms. We have heard Ruchel on some of the roots, how things have changed over a period of 10 years. And after 10 years since 2005 and now 2015, some of the path-breaking policy changes that have come in. So what's your thoughts, Nishchal, if I may continue with you,
mm-hmm.
in terms of some of these routes and the platforms which are set up and
mm-hmm.
the structures which are there, considering the new policies, how do you see some of the new structures coming up in terms of the real estate sector?
Mm-hmm. So I think interestingly, the way, I mean, we have seen the sector from 2005 to 2015, and the way the fundraising has happened in the sector, if you see pre-2008 days, most of the funds were raised through the fund structure, where the LPs gave free hand to the GPs and LPs followed a hands-off approach. And the result was also not that great because significant returns were not given to the LPs by the GPs. And we saw post-2008, because of the global financial crisis, the fundraising was almost dormant for the next 3 to 4 years. But in 2012, we saw the emergence of platform structures with, Godrej APG being the first real estate platform in India. And we saw the pension funds and sovereign wealth funds being more inclined towards the platform model rather than a fund model. Because what they wanted was more involvement in the decision making for investment and divestment, more accountability of the GPs, and work more like partners rather than, GP taking all decisions and LPs just receiving information reports from the GP on what's happening on the project. So that's where we saw the shift to the platform structures with, first being Godrej APG, then we also saw ADIA, Kotak platform, we also saw Canadian Pension Fund, Piramal platform, and Heinz ADIA was another platform. So we saw the emergence of platform, and if you see currently, a lot of fundraising which is happening is based on the platform structure more than the fund structure. And hopefully, as Karan mentioned, that with the GP also establishing the track record, we might see again the emergence of fund structure as compared to the platform structure, just like we are seeing the resurgence of equity structures compared to debt structures in the last 1 year. So that's something which is an interesting change which we are seeing. As far as the domestic fundraising is concerned, we saw a change in 2012 when alternative investment fund regime was introduced, where category 2 AIFs were permitted to raise debt, or rather what we call debt AIFs for real estate. And there we saw many domestic fund managers raising funds through that route. But at the same time, one of the biggest issue with debt AIF was that the debt AIF cannot leverage except for temporary requirements. So from a tax perspective, even though the AIF are given pass-through treatment, but ultimately the investors still end up paying taxes on the capital gains and interest which is received from the real estate project. But at the same time, what we also saw was with the AIF, we also saw mushrooming of NBFCs in India. And we saw some of the big players globally foraying into the NBFC business, like GICs, KKR, Vikram Pandit, JM Financial. All the large NBFCs have been set up in the last couple of years, and there is a huge there are a lot of deals which are happening through the NBFC platform as compared to the AIF platform. And coupled with NBFC, what we also saw post-2008 was the listed bond structure, where number of offshore debt funds were raised because, as I mentioned, it became very difficult for the LPs to get their money back on the equity funds, given the fact that the Indian laws also became very complicated to take out money in an equity structure. There was a buyback tax which was introduced a couple of years back, where 20% income distribution tax has to be paid on the buyback. There were issues on the put option with assured IRR. So all the deals which were structured where foreign investor had a put option on Indian developer all came under the scanner of the Reserve Bank of India. So equity deals became very complicated, because of which post 2008 we saw a number of debt funds coming up. And with debt, the best product to invest through a debt was the listed bond product. And there have been a number of deals which have happened in the last 7 to 8 years through the listed bond product, and because it gives best of both worlds, you can pretty much get the same equity type of returns on the bond, and at the same time it gives you the same security as a lender. Because of that, the product became very popular, and till date also we have been seeing majority of the funds using the listed bond as a product. So broadly, you know, this is what we have been seeing as far as the fund model and the fund structures are concerned. And from a jurisdiction perspective, I think not much has changed as far as offshore pooling is concerned. For equity structures, Mauritius and Singapore are used a lot. For debt structures, we have seen Singapore and Netherlands also being used a lot because of you know, the preferential treatment which you get on interest coupon because of the India-Singapore and India-Netherlands tax treaty.
Okay, so maybe giving a little possible rest to Michel and going back to Ruchir and coming to his favorite structure, particularly the NCD you know, structures. What are your thoughts in terms of some of the issues people face in that structure? Is there a particular issue like the three-year lock-ins or any other points that one needs to consider? And with the new FDI regime and the other structures available, will this structure still remain most interesting structure, or you will see a change in terms of people preferring some different structure?
Yeah, no, I think I obviously feel very strongly about NCDs. We have in many of the sessions, I think I've tried to allay the misapprehensions that people have about listed non-convertible debentures. I think all of you will know about this, but these are essentially bonds that an Indian company can issue, and any registered foreign investor, which is registered as a foreign portfolio investor, and that registration is very simple these days. Almost any non-resident can register as a foreign portfolio investor, can subscribe to these bonds, and these bonds can have whatever commercial characteristic that you want them to have. They can have security interest because these are pure debt bonds and they're rupee denominated. You can have whatever security interest that you want through a local security trustee. Whatever payout on the bond can be structured in the form of a coupon and a redemption premium, with the redemption premium being linked to a commercial formula. It can be several deals have happened, actually even equity deals happen on the listed bond platform, because bond is just a mechanism of how you invest. But if the inherent nature is, let's say, payable when able, so that means that you have to pay nothing on the bond, neither the coupon nor the redemption premium, unless the company has cash flows, then it really is functioning like equity. It's a structured form of equity giving you debt-like tax deductions. So obviously it is extremely popular, and many times people ask that, is this legit? Are you trying to do something very cute by saying that, you know, oh, you know what, it's a bond, but it's really functioning like equity, and will someone come and catch us? And, you know, the answer always is that, you know, how I borrow and how someone lends is really a function of commercial discussions between the parties. They can be lending and borrowing in whatever commercial terminologies. Someone might say that I will lend you at 12%, but you must pay me irrespective of having cash flows. And someone might say, you know, I will charge you 18%, but you pay me later, or pay me as and when cash flows come. So that's really a commercial function of how you want to structure your bond. And I think in 2008, when this regime came up for the first time, the idea of the government was that, you know, we had a buoyant equity market, but we did not have a debt market. Globally, about 25 to 30%, or even up to 40% of the debt needs of a company.
The conference is now being recorded.
So up to 40% of the debt needs of a company are typically met by way of corporate bonds. And in India, the only way people thought of raising funding or debt funding was just go to bank, which is not correct. So the government thought that, you know, let's introduce this simplified form of debt listing or simplified form of debt, where an Indian company could even borrow through, you know, listed bonds, and we will have an equally buoyant debt market, just like we have a buoyant equity market, if you call it buoyant at all. So that was the framework within which the debt market was opened up in 2008, and over the years it became increasingly popular even for equity, structured equity or whatever kind of structures that were there. But I think nothing can go very smoothly you know, in this country. So then they came up with the concept of commitment to capital, and they wanted to kill the entire CP paper, you know, or the commercial paper market, or short-term trading of bonds. And they said, you know, there must be some kind of commitment. So, you know what, there should be a 3-year lock-in in terms of bonds. And in this early this February, just when the bonds were the most favorite way of doing deals, they came up with a circular saying that, you know, every bond must have a 3-year residual maturity, which was investor specific. That means if an FPI or a foreign portfolio investor had to acquire any of those bonds, they must have a 3-year residual maturity, right? So therefore, if you're transferring that bond to another non-resident, he can also not acquire those bonds, even though they are listed, unless that other foreign, unless the residual maturity when the other non-resident or the foreign portfolio investor acquires is also 3 years. Now, 3 years wasn't just sufficient. So the, and this circular was issued by the RBI on, you know, and then subsequently, first issued by SEBI, then subsequently by the RBI on the same date, but then they came up with certain FAQs or clarifications, because, you know, 3-year residual maturity, people were confused that can you pay something, can you redeem some part of the principal or not? And the view that came out across from the market was no, you cannot redeem any part of the bond, because residual maturity was then understood in the most conservative manner to mean no part of principal can be redeemed. Otherwise, some people were cute enough to say, let's redeem 99% in the first 2 years and just remain 1% for later. So then they said, you know, the question came up that can you have amortization possible in these bonds? And, you know, the RBI clarified. The RBI said, yes, amortization is possible, and provided you maintain the average maturity of 3 years. But in the way the question was worded was that the question talked about average maturity, but the answer to the same FAQ, and you will see that in the hotline, the answer talked about, yes, amortization is possible, provided the duration of the bond is 3 years. Now, people were confused because from a bond terminology perspective, maturity and duration are two very different concepts. Duration can be computed by way of your Macaulay, advanced Macaulay formulas and all of that, and average maturity was really a concept, you know, where, you know, you use the ECB type average maturity concept. So people got confused how to, you know, how to do. And while the market has been doing a majority of the deals based on ECB based average maturity, the challenge is that with amortized bonds, the way the language reads of duration, there is also some section which has gone to the RBI, and RBI has given some kind of a position that, you know, you must use the Macaulay formula for computing the duration of the bond. So there are two sects which are prevailing right now. Now the question, I think, Karan, it's one of your kind of questions. What does a person do when there are different views in the market? Do I not redeem anything of the bond at all? Do I use ECB-based weighted average maturity principle? Or do I use the Macaulay formula, which really kills my deal, right? And or advanced Macaulay, which is even more complicated. So I think where you end up is that, you know, go back to the RBI, and RBI has just recently again clarified to us in a separate matter that this is only ECB maturity concept, and the word duration is really used in a more generic sense, but they did not intend it to be duration as per the Macaulay formula. So that's one view. Go to your custodian bank, go to your authorized dealer, take his view, back it up with legal opinions, and just do the deal. That's how, and most of the deals in the market have happened on the basis of ECB or the average maturity principle. If you can work out a Macaulay, nothing like it, but there are deals happening on the other formula also of ECB weighted average methodology, where you take the term duration in a more generic sense. Because when the law, when the clarification is itself not clear, how do you interpret? Then that's the way to interpret. You go to the RBI, go to the custodian, take appropriate legal opinions, back yourself and do the deal, and cite the precedents.
So, Mr. do you have a different interpretation?
So, I can't because we work together. But I think generally, as Richard mentioned, the two circulars have complicated life a lot. And just like I think the FDI policy changes came after the Bihar elections, we hope that, you know, the West Bengal elections will also clarify a lot of things for the FPI circular. So I think in addition to what Ruchir said, I think there are a couple of other issues which are there in the FPI bond circular. And I think one major issue is the circular FAQ specifically mentioned that no put or call options are permitted within the 3-year maturity period. The question is, does the put or call option work only vis-a-vis the borrower, or even the promoter of the borrower cannot enter into a put or call option agreement with the foreign investor. I think there ideally, because it's a bond and not equity, typically it should be, ideally it should be between the borrower and the lender. But because there is no clarity on this, the view that, you know, we have been taking is that it's better to not enter into any type of option arrangement even with the promoter. And then the question comes as to, can you, if not an option arrangement, can you enter into a binding arrangement with the promoter, because transfer of bonds to resident is allowed within the 3-year period. The problem there is that because this is a listed bond, the Securities Contract Regulation Act applies to it. And because of that, any type of forward contract that you enter into with respect to a bond where you are fixing the price and fixing the date for purchase of the bond, it could get covered under forward contract, which are not permitted, you know, under the SCRA. So that's really the challenge we are facing, and, you know, one of the structure which typically comes up is, in case there is money which is lying in the company, the foreign investor finds a domestic NBFC which will buy the bond, because transfer to domestic resident without any contract is permitted. And then the domestic NBFC can, once the bond is purchased by the domestic NBFCs, the borrower will redeem the bond to the domestic NBFC. So it's more of a bridge funding which takes care of the redemption issue before 3 years. But again, you need to structure it properly. Sometimes the discussion comes up on, if not NBFC, can the promoter himself do it? Because the promoter company can purchase the bond and, you know, or the borrower can give a loan to the promoter company, and then promoter company can use the same money to purchase the bond without any contract. But there again, the challenge is it might defeat the spirit of the regulations. So one of the things that, you know, to better the structure, one of the things which can be looked at is, first the promoter borrows from a third party, buys it, and then, you know, redemption happens from the borrower to the promoter. That's a more kosher structure as compared to a structure where the promoter is being funded by the borrower, because what you are doing indirectly is something which is not allowed directly. So that's these are the you know, the two things which we have seen are again creating a lot of issues for FPI's investment in the listed bond.
I think just to add, these are actually very interesting times, and we are pushing on this on the policy side for clarity on this bond lock-in issue, and hopefully it should be sorted. And we are also getting written responses that it will actually be computed as per the ECB weighted average maturity, you know, concept. But these are interesting times, as I said, also in light of the entire opening up of the commercial asset space. So REITs haven't been successful in India, and one of the reasons has been that the entire taxation regime, there are many taxation issues. Obviously, there are many commercial issues. I don't want to repeat all that. There's not a REIT session. But one of the challenges is that from a domestic investor perspective, it wasn't working well from a tax standpoint. But with the bonds coming in and with the commercial space opening up, all the LRD and the CMBS market can now fully and freely open up, and you can actually have offshore pooling structures, you know, which will use the listed bonds and all of it. And therefore, I think this 3-year lock-in is going to be very, very critical to understand for these kind of structures to work. But in many senses, I do see a resurgence of Singapore-based pooling vehicles, the SBTs, the London listed vehicles, using that to monetize on Indian commercial assets.
Karan as well, I think legal and regulatory aspects, obviously, Ruchi and Michelle have elaborated a lot, but what are the other things on top of your mind when you look at an investment or partnering with any developer in India? Are certain check the boxes always there in your mind as to, okay, unless it is 1, 2 and 3, I'm not going to, you know, look at any investment and maybe
I'll let Matsuo take that, since he wants to partner with us.
Firstly, for this country, I knew, but I was so impressed about this, all the structures and also rules. In this kind of group, you know, developing countries, it's very rare. My experience is not so broad, but experience in other country in Asia, China or Vietnam or those market, there is no structure like this. And I was so impressed. You guys are so smart. You guys can think of so many rules, and it's good in a way that we can structure the risk and return in the debt and equity, and in the debt to provide some, this NCD provide us some good way to redeem the capital, which doesn't happen in other countries. So that's very a good part. The other thing is that Richard's point, that this new deregulation give us a chance to look into this income producing property.
Yeah.
I mean, for foreign investors' point of view, it's easy to buying into this income producing property, but you know, I was thinking until last week, I can't do this. So I'm right now, I am trying to participate in a project with a joint venture with the developer for a residential project. My thought process is trying this small project and having a good market exit and trying to move into this income-producing property. But now, this new opportunity come up, so I'd like to look into this long-term. I mean, originally I told you the Japanese have such a small cost of capital and a long-term view, it's natural to go into this income-producing property like office and long-term holding. These new change give us more chance, and also having us coming in, I think your more capital, not only Japan, from the rest of the world, the capital coming in, the cost of capital for real estate is going to go down, which is going to give you a good upside potential for the growth. I think it's a good cycle it will start. But coming back to your question about how I look into this joint venture partner, I think the most important thing is, since this cultural and also legal difference is so big, I think I'd like to have some good transparency from the developing partner, and also understanding how different I am from you guys. If the developer understands some kind of maybe Western or American or in Japanese, developed countries, way of doing business, that makes us so easy to going in. Actually, in this country, there are so many developers who has done dealt with the foreign capital so far. That's also very surprising, and I'm very happy to deal with these guys. And also, as I said, they give us more transparency. I know there's some murky area in the market in this country. I mean, this is not only your country. Real estate is in real estate. Same in U.S., Japan. We have to deal with this. But as long as they give us all the transparency to us, we understand this, so we can swallow some of the issues. But how much we can swallow, if I understand, I can gauge it. I can talk into my investor, so I can deal with it. So transparency is probably the most important part.
Any thoughts, Karan?
This is my only thought on it is earlier I commented that we think that there will be a resurgence of the fund structure, maybe not exactly blind pool right away, but I think it will evolve into that through some more innovation. But it's not maybe just the Indian managers. So if Matsuo and then are going to come in, then the foreign managers will by default bring in the fund structure. So I don't think fund structure is dead. I think it's going to come back with the foreign managers and then Indian managers, and that, I think that is the future.
Sure. So no discussion on innovative structures can end without tax being discussed. So what are your thoughts in terms of the tax structuring issues, more particularly to NCDs or any other tax issues that you see in this roots?
Yeah.
And are they still on the top of the mind when the structuring happens, or they have somewhere matured, particularly with the structures? Maybe Ruchir and Nishal, maybe 5 minutes on that.
Sure. I think one of the questions, at least, I mean, obviously, larger amount of deals in the real estate space, especially whether it's income producing or self-liquidating, do require an element of debt from a tax optimization perspective. Deductions is what everyone needs. And that's probably one of the reasons why NCDs became so popular. I think the question that many times comes across is that what is the nature of this redemption premium that we get on the bonds? And I think So let's analyze that from a couple of perspectives, from the borrower perspective and the lender perspective or the investor perspective. From a borrower perspective, at least, you know, the concept is quite clear that whatever you pay, whether by way of coupon or by redemption premium, any payout on a bond is actually in the nature of a revenue expense and a deductible for the borrower company, and there is absolutely no debate on that. That has been settled in many cases, in Madras Investment Supreme Court case and many other cases. That debate has been set out. The challenge that many times comes across is that from an investor perspective, what is the treatment in their hands? And many investors are very keen to regard this as a capital gains treatment to kind of achieve a 0% tax benefit, especially if they're coming from jurisdictions like Mauritius or Singapore, where there is no capital gains tax under the Singapore-India-Mauritius treaty. And even though, by the way, there has been, so from a tax perspective, these bonds, because they can only be purchased by a foreign portfolio investor, these are listed bonds, the withholding tax or the ultimate tax rate on these bonds is 20% at the hands of the recipient. That 20% tax gets reduced to 15% in case of Singapore. It gets reduced to 10% in case of Netherlands. And there is no tax treaty with respect to interest beneficial treatment with Mauritius, although we are expecting that there should be some change in that. So you can come in from whichever jurisdiction, but obviously there is some amount of tax leakage no matter where you come from. If you could actually qualify this as a form of capital gains, you could save on the entire tax leakage. Now, there is obviously one school of thought, but one is that, you know, from conceptually, there is no law that requires reconciliation of the books of the borrower and the lender. Both books are independent. Both people can record the assets and incomes differently. So from a lender perspective, even though the borrower recorded is very, very clear as a revenue expense, from a investor or from a lender perspective, the treatment, can that be of interest income or capital gains? Now let's analyze how can it ever be capital gains. From a treaty perspective, redemption premium, whatever you give, is actually in many of the treaties, you know, the way they define interest includes redemption premium. But from a Indian Income Tax Act perspective, redemption premium or redemption of a bond, because the asset, once they hold the bond, is actually a capital asset. And that's the law also now. After the 2014 amendment, there's a requirement that any investment held by a foreign portfolio investor will be held as a capital asset. So when you transfer a capital asset, it should typically be earning capital gains. Now, transfer definition includes transfer, whether you are transferring on the floor or extinguishment of a capital asset. Redemption is nothing else but extinguishment of a capital asset. So from the perspective of characterizing the nature, it's your call whether you can take it as interest, because that definition is also wide, or capital gains. The way we can look at it, and many people have looked at it in the past, and there are many examples of this, is that it is really from a Domestic Income Tax Act perspective, you know, capital gains, because it's extinguishing the capital asset. Now, and you can obviously choose, the SSE is at benefit to choose when, whichever provision works better for him. And again, from the perspective of the treaty and the Income Tax Act, you're again free to choose whichever is more beneficial. So for the characterization of the income, you take it as capital gains, and then you go to the treaty to only examine what is the rate or how will the capital gains be taxed. Where, you know, if it's India-Singapore or India-Mauritius treaty, you know, you could characterize it as capital gains, and you could, you know, take, you know, the capital gains exemption subject to the LOB provision in Singapore or wherever it's applicable. I think the market practice is really, the more conservative view is really to take it as interest, but this is one of the thoughts which, you know, you people can explore. It is technically viable, but obviously, when you don't pay any tax to the government of India, they don't like it, so you might expect some questions, but that's the way it can work. Second part is, many people say, because there is a restricted, you know, if your coupon is up to 14% of the way they call it SBI base rate plus 500 bips, you know, you're subjected to a much lower withholding tax. The 20% base tax rate gets reduced to 5%. Many people ask that, you know, should I be subjected? So I'll keep my coupon to 10% and I'll keep my redemption premium as, you know, as over and above that. right? Is that possible or not? Now again, it goes back to the, and then will I still be subject to the 5% benefit, or will I be required to pay a higher, or will I not be entitled to, because my overall bond payout is more than 15%. Now the way the provisions read is that they only talk about interest income in the hands of the recipient. So if the interest income, not interest expense, so if the interest income at the hands of the recipient is up to 14%, the withholding should only be 5%. So now it's up to you how you're categorizing. If you're categorizing your redemption premium as capital gains, then obviously your interest income is only up to 14%, then it should be 5%. If in your books you're reflecting your redemption premium as a form of interest income, then obviously you are breaching the 14% and your withholding should be the maximum of 20%, unless it's reduced to 15% or 10% case of Singapore or Netherlands. So that's again one of the, from a tax perspective, how these kind of bonds can work.
Just one last point, I think all this structuring is good till 1st April 2017, because from 1st April 2017 the general anti-evidence rules are going to come in. And hence, what would be most important is a lot of funds which are being raised right now, how the fund documents are drafted, how the board minutes are drafted, all these things will become very important, because one of the things which the tax authorities are going to look at is if any investment has been made post 1st April 2017, they will apply the general anti-evidence provisions, and if they see that the debt instrument has the character of equity, then there are high chances that the interest will be considered as dividend, which will be subject to dividend distribution tax. So I think it's very important how we look at these things, how the documents are drafted, how we structure the debenture terms, what rights you are giving to the investor. So you have to balance between the commercial requirement of the rights versus the tax exposure that those rights can create for the investor to get a preferential treatment.
But also any structures which you do now will be grandfathered.
Yeah.
So any investments which you make,
any investment,
structure.
Yeah. So it's applicable only for investments made post 1st April 2017. But I think before we end, maybe Vyapak, we can swap the roles. I can be moderator for one question. I think recently there have been significant changes which have been announced as far as the dispute resolution mechanism is concerned. And what we saw from 2010-11 to 2013, there were a number of disputes which happened between the real estate funds and the developers. Is there anything good, or is there any reply for the foreign investors in the new proposals?
Yeah, so it's always good to have the last word, right? And as dispute lawyers or litigators, I think you usually have the last word or the last laugh, as we say. But yeah, I think recently government has really responded to the much needed changes and amendments the way the dispute resolution happens in India. They have come up with two ordinances, one in terms of again very very substantial changes in the Arbitration Act. And if I may just take a couple of minutes because I think you might want to open the floor for questions and answers, but I think there were two or three major problems in terms of foreign investors' disputes with the Indians, particularly on the real estate side. I think one was the delay itself, that it took endless time when the dispute started till the dispute even reached a particular stage. It took, considerable time. I think the amendments talk about making sure that the delay aspect is addressed at every level of arbitration. And the way the amendments have come about, it is even beyond some of the global standards. As Envy said, you go to any institution, they will say it will at least take 18 months to 24 months, while this law says initially the period should be 12 months. So I think obviously it's an aggressive view to what has happened in the past, and we'll see how it turns out. But the message is very clear that if we have to bring about ease of doing business in India, I think dispute resolution is going to be one important criteria. So I think at every stage delays have been addressed in arbitration, and it is now time bound of 12 months with maximum of 6 months of extension unless court approves any further extension. Otherwise, even arbitrator is penalized for his views. So they have taken care of those situations when it comes to delay. The other big problem was with the kind of jurisprudence came about right from 2002 to 2012. There was always a question as to if it is a foreign seated arbitration, whether I can go to Indian courts, or whether it is only in Indian courts I can go to interim reliefs and, you know, things like that. I think the law again clarifies the situation, because original judgments allowed even foreign seated arbitrations to go to Indian courts in certain situations, while the later judgments completely barred that position. So then people were again perplexed in the sense that, okay, if I seek my arbitration outside, but if I need to go to Indian courts, what do I do? So the new amendments take care of those situations where you can even go to Indian courts if there has been a carve out in your arbitration clause with regard to foreign seated arbitration. The third most important concept which is coming up for the first time in India is the cost follow event. Now this is very prevalent in all the developed jurisdictions, which was not there in India. So now it is explicit in the law that whoever is successful should get all the costs that they have incurred in the process from the other side to get through that process. Now this was never there, and this is going to be one of the major deterrents for counterclaims or claims which were not real claims in that sense, but were made just to delay the process. Because at the end of the day, if you have to really pay the costs of the other side, even defending such frivolous claims, then you will have to even pay for not only your lawyers and the fees of arbitrator, but even the other side. So I think some of these changes are going to really change the way it happens, but ultimately I think it is the culture and the mindset, right? So we'll obviously see how things work out in the future, but definitely the law and the regulations have given a clear direction in this regard. So I think there are two or three aspects if I touch upon, particularly on the real estate side, right? One is your security enforcement issues. One would say, okay, I have to go to courts, but what about my adjudication? I can still do it through arbitration. Earlier, that route was also not very exciting, because that in itself was taking 5, 6, 7 years. Now, at least that process, either in India or outside, you will be able to do at much faster pace and in a time-bound manner, so that your security enforcement stage comes much earlier by the time your adjudication things are over. Second is your multi-party, multi-agreement situations, where every time it was an issue as to who are all involved in this dispute, whether it is the promoter entity or only the SPV. We have two different agreements, two different lending arrangements. I think now with the law changing even for domestic arbitrations, some of these issues can be dealt much more efficiently, and you will be able to club a lot of disputes into one to get things clarified. And the last but not the least is the whole new regime of commercial courts. Now we have seen this in many, many situations. In debt recovery we saw tribunals, in IP, intellectual property, we saw separate tribunals, securities we have SEBI and SET, but commercial courts like Singapore or like London, I think at least the concept has been introduced and made a law where specific commercial courts are being set up for commercial disputes, which will cover any and every dispute that we are talking about here. And again, there the way the timelines are fixed, it talks about 16 to 18 months to complete the whole process, include a case management timelines. So the whole civil procedure code, which was coming in the way in terms of enforcement and the procedures in the court, has been done away for commercial courts. A new case management process has been brought in terms of written submissions and written arguments, time-bound filings, even taking away rights. So the whole natural justice defense has been taken care of by putting some of the strict timelines. So I think a combination of arbitration regime and commercial courts will throw upon a lot of different avenues as to how you put your dispute resolution clause ultimately in the agreements. And possibly we might be seeing some innovations there as well, because even commercial courts can throw upon a lot of different options, and not just arbitrations, which are today a norm in this kind of
business. So in a sense, when we used to say that if there's a dispute, investors are a very vulnerable community, so you have two sets. First is liability crystallization, proving that there is a default also or not, and second is enforcement of that award. Together, this can take even about 8, 10 years, sometimes 12 years and all that. Now that reduces to...
At least the regulation
within the life
of
the fund.
Support it, and we'll see how it obviously spans out. So coupled with a lot of other changes, the government has also taken care of some of these issues, and we'll see how it spans out.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and 1 on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and 2. Participants are requested to use only handset while asking questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. Audio participants, if you have any questions, please press star and 1. The first question is from the line of Atul Ambawar from Ambawar Associates. Please proceed.
Yeah, I have a question relating to FDI in completed assets. So, you know, just wanted to ask if now it is with the changes coming in, whether it is permitted in pre-leased properties.
Yeah, so the regulations obviously allow you to invest in pre-leased or income generating properties, or it's a shopping mall or a
business
or a business center, and the definition of business center is wide enough to actually cover any kind of commercial complex the way it is.
So even standalone properties are now covered?
Yeah. Yes, they are.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. A reminder to our audio participants, if you have any questions, please press star and 1. Next question is from the line of Anandjeet Sundaraj from Peninsula Brooksfield. Please proceed.
Hi, yes. Hi, good evening, guys. My question is on the three-year maturity or the lock-in that we have. So you said the maturity principle could be the ECB maturity principle. So could you just give us some color in terms of, I know it's still not very clear, that's what the panelists had said, but in terms of the ECB maturity principle, what does it mean? And is there a way to shrink the down the tenure period, as someone had mentioned? So how does one do it? Would be very insightful. Thank you.
So there is obviously lack of clarity is what I said. And based on the discussions, the most recent discussions that we've had, and we are expecting something in written, is that, you know, it's really the average maturity as you compute from the ECB perspective, and the term duration is used more in a generic sense. But obviously this is only oral right now, so there are different views of computation which are still prevailing. So I think you should consult your custodian also. Also have separate meetings, because duration can only be done by Macaulay, but have your discussions. But most recently what would be heard is that RBI has insisted that it will just be the ECB kind of formula, and the term duration is used in a more generic sense.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We would like to remind our participants that you may press star and 1 if you have any questions. Next question is from Salonisha from NASHA Associates. Please proceed.
Hello. Currently in the LSP, 50% FDI is permitted where no FDI-linked performance conditions are there. Now in real estate, if the two major conditions, that is minimum area norm basis, isn't this now permitted in LLP?
So we already mentioned that that LLP is not allowed for real estate.
LLP is not allowed for real estate because one of the performance link condition of lock-in for 3 years is still there.
So lock-in will be considered as a performance link condition.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Keval Pillai from PwC. Please proceed.
Hi. Since now FDI is allowed,
Mr. Pillai, your voice is breaking, sir.
Yeah, so is it clear now?
Yes.
Yeah, so since FDI is allowed in LLPs, just wanted to understand whether an outside trust can invest in an LLP.
So, again, if the question is from the context of real estate, as we mentioned, FDI in real estate LLPs is not allowed because the real estate sector still has the condition of lock-in. So, whether a trust invest in LLP or a corporate invest in LLP, for real estate, LLPs are still not allowed for foreign investment.
And for the other classes, I think you should determine who the for non-real estate, say, of operating company and all, you should determine who the trustee of the trust is, because LLP can only have individuals or body corporate as a member or as a partner. So you should determine on who the trustee is.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe
thank you.
Just
as there are no further questions from the audio participants, I hand over the conference to Mr. Apak Desai for closing remarks.
If we have any questions from...
We can open the floor here as well.
As far as NRIs are concerned, you clarified that now NRO account money will be treated as not as a foreign currency investment.
Correct.
So the NRI transfer first to NRE account and then transfer from there to NRO account, the color will be, is it the NRO meaning only the original Indian money, or is it the transfer from NRE to NRO is permitted?
No, so the important thing is from which account the investment was made.
NRO.
Then it will be considered as domestic investment.
So even the source is NRE.
Yeah. Because once it's in NRO account, when you exit, the money will go to NRO account only, and there is a limit of $1 million. That's the maximum you can take out in a year. So that's where the restriction with the government wants, or the checks and balances with the government wants, is there in the NRO account.
Recently, in a SEBI has clarified, in a security transaction where NRIs who were transferring money to NRE first, then transferring to NRO and buying the shares of B category shares, where you must be aware that you can only buy up to a certain percentage of the shareholding.
Yeah.
And where it exceeded, the SEBI has taken a view that if the original source of the money was NRE, then this NRO will not qualify to exceed beyond that particular
level. Is there an informal guidance on that, or is just
verbal? No, that was a live case which we took up with SEBI, and they have clarified that we will not
qualify. That may be more from a listed
perspective.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. This question is for Karan. That you mentioned that you were amongst the first guys to use the platform.
That's right.
And it has been successful. Mm-hmm. Yet you're talking of going to the fund structure.
Correct.
So can you just give what are the advantages that you view in a fund structure over your existing platform structure?
Yes, so I think the advantages are twofold. One, to us, that's our business model, right? So we want to proceed with us, and the economics change quite drastically from a platform structure to a fund structure. So that's one. I think the other thing is that a fund structure is really a bespoke structure. So when you go and meet an investor, typically an investor who's not very large or very sophisticated, like the types who we've seen coming into India, like an RDR, APG, or CPPIB or somebody like that, their expectation is that you come to them with a fully laid out bespoke structure that takes care of their investments all the way to FDI and the repatriations all the way. So as I was actually bringing up on the panel, like while we're able to sort of work with these structures and innovate, some of the problems that we face is that the structure itself has a lot of gray areas. And that is something we're trying to work with, you know, from our own corporate side as well as the advisors, to see if we can address some of those issues and make it more world-class and black and white.
Thank you.
I have a question. On the lock-in of 3 years, is it possible now to go ahead and sell the piece of land that is essentially the asset in the company that we've invested in?
Not before 3 years.
After 3 years?
But only thing is that from a spirit perspective, you should have at least made some development or at least efforts to develop the project. It can't just be that money comes in for the purchase of land, foreign money comes for purchase of land parcel. Nothing is done for the development of the project. You sit on the land for 3 years and after 3 years you sell the land. I think that's something which from a spirit perspective is not something which the government is looking at. That yeah, see, though, that's what I'm saying. So one is intent, and also whether you are able to demonstrate yourself to tomorrow if there is an inquiry which comes from the regulator. None of the opinions, nothing is going to help you on this. What will help you is you able to demonstrate that I made efforts, something which is beyond your control, to develop the project in the first 3 years. If you are able to demonstrate that, and then you say that okay, we have not been able to do anything, and you know, the project, you know, couldn't start, and now we want to exit by selling the land. I think that's something that, you know, we can take a view that, you know, because all efforts were made and, you know, it was done in a bona fide manner, it should be fine. But at the same time, there will always be this element of risk involved when there is no development which has taken place and there is something which was out, you know, within your control and you didn't do it.
I think the question is, let me also add, this is just 3 years, nothing. This was also in Press Note 2, 2005. And therefore, I think the question should be, there are two separate elements that you need to address. First is the issue of capital account transactions, where real estate business is totally prohibited. The other is construction development, right? So the way you look at it is that, what was your intent first? Let's say you were trying to set up a wind farm. You buy land for it. You do your feasibility study. The land is not suitable. You sell off the land. Are you real estate business? No. You are trying to set up a wind farm. So you're an operating company. So your first step is to set up and, you know, to intend that, what is your intent? And intent can't be just that you write in a board meeting. I think it has to be a genuine and a bona fide case of establishing what your intent is. The second concept is, now what happens if you set up a company, but for some reason, even despite your all efforts, because you're only an investor, you could not do it. For those bona fide cases, how long should you be held up? Because we wanted commitment to capital. Those commitment of capital you've demonstrated. So how long should you be held up? So we said it should be a bench. It can be 3 years, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. The policy talks about a 3-year benchmarking process. So 3 years, if you fulfill, then technically you can exit. You can exit before, if the project is completed. You can exit before the trunk infrastructure. So these are two very independent processes. And whenever you're talking about, in the larger context, whenever you talk about issues of, you know, assuming 3 years, please, no one should assume that you can do speculative land trading activity, come in, hold the land for 3 years and then just sell off and make windfall gains. No, that's not the idea. This 3 year is a benefit given to bona fide investors who, despite their efforts, could not do anything. That's the idea.
So, I think, obviously, when you are exiting, no one is going to stop you from exiting. It's only post that if questions are raised, right? And at that point in time, if you are not able to show on paper and by not only intention but by conduct that there was enough done to develop the property, I think obviously there would be a problem. So again, some of these provisions will have to be read, as he's saying, from a spirit perspective, that idea is to try for 3 years. If not, then at least you have stayed for 3 years. If you do it early, you can exit early. If not, after 3 years we'll let you go.
And I can tell you some of the questions that the FIPB would ask you. Did you have a project monitoring committee? Did your board meeting evidence that? Did your shareholders meeting evidence that? How soon did you meet? What were your challenges? Did you push for it? Did you push for approvals? What applications? I think the concept is, you can do everything what you want to do if you want to be cute. I think the question is, justify to your own, sir. Justify to your own conscience. Were you really trying to develop and you couldn't do it? Then I think you're in the clear. You can't justify to yourself, you can't justify to FIPB for sure.
I have two questions. One to Richard and one to Michelle. So you mentioned that in last 10 years cycle, it was earlier the equities and pure equity, then listed NCD and listed NCD, and now again back to the equity. What's the particular reason any of that? That's question number one. And compared to question number two, it's really encouraging that now the real estate FDI again is in a good scale. But we are also hearing that the RERA is also going to come. If RERA comes, the real estate development and regulations, there is a restriction of putting 50% of the amount from the sales proceedings of the apartment into the escrow. We need to have an increment from the FDI point of view, you know, investing into it.
Yeah, so maybe on your first question on why did the flavor change from equity to debt. 2005 was when we just opened up. Everyone was buoyant. People and our mothers tell us, you know, two things essential: buy gold, get married, and buy real estate, right? So these three things became very important.
They are very different than Japan.
They are not very different than Japan. Even China. By the way, I was told that in China, you know, no man would give their daughter unless the boy had real estate. So you know, that kind of build up a perception that, you know, real estate will grow enormously. And people promised whatever to their LPs, you know, enormous returns, you know, exorbitant, you know, returns which were not possible, 25, 30, 35, 40, whatever numbers were floating around. I think over the years, there was a tempering of those expectations. We realized that real estate is at the end of an asset class. It's a stable asset class, and it will grow on a stable basis. So the returns cannot be measured with, you know, cannot be those exponential. Once the returns are stabilized and there is a hard asset, and somewhere down the line, some of the promoters also acted very cute and tried to arm twist the promoters, arm twist the investors, and I think that's where the interest and that's where the mentality also came in, to secure or to have some kind of debt-like mindset. And unlike tech or somewhere where a private equity investor is seen like getting a tremendous amount of value, real estate, no matter what you say, a promoter only sees you as a moneylender, expensive or a cheap moneylender. So I think the mindset was kind of driven by that to some extent, and the kind of cases that happened. So tempered expectations of around 20%, which you could get even in case of debt, security creation, and coupled with that, the stable cash flows which keep coming in real estate. So you don't really have to wait for 5 years. On day one, you're having it. So the model entirely changed. And obviously, there are different parameters for equity, different for debt. So now with, you know, some people who've done equity have actually done taking equity like any other asset class, like tech. Like, you know, you're investing into a brand which is into construction services. That's not really real estate investment, I would say. It's, you know, it's more like investment into construction services. So there are different parameters for different things, but that's how debt came in. And
I think mainly it's to do with the risk appetite. I think when the sector opened up, the risk appetite was very high. The investors invested with second, third tier developers, and they, you know, burned their fingers. And then the idea was to protect the capital, which is where the debt fund started coming in. And on debt, I think the benefit is that in case of equity, when you invest, till the time the exit happens, you don't get anything, because dividend is something which is not a tax efficient way to get money back. So as an LP, you are expecting your money back after 6 to 7 years of putting your money on day one. Versus in a debt structure, you can structure the coupon which can keep coming quarterly, you know, annually. At least they see something coming back, which gives a lot of comfort to the LP, especially LPs who have lost money in India. And that's where the debt funds, that's where the debt investment started. And now the new resurgence which we are seeing on equity is not the same we saw in 2005 to 2008. These equity deals which are happening are with very select developers. It's not the developers, you know, who thought that, you know, having a project in Nasik, you'll get $100 million of funding. Now it's very focused in metros and, you know, a couple of other cities. Very select developers, like the platform deals, if you see, are happening with all the top-tier developers like Piramal, top-tier, you know, fund managers and developers like Godrej Properties, Piramals, and, you know.
And I think just to add, there are many, very few developers, you know, Rajiva, like Tata Housing or Godrej, like you guys, with whom people want to take a business risk. You can't take a business risk with a name you don't trust. And that's why equity is very limited, very few. I think that's the bottom line of it, of all of it.
And just on your second question on if 50% is put in escrow, I don't think, first of all, it will ever get passed, given the strong developer community. And as long as that escrow money goes to the investors would be happy with that, but I don't think all those things are envisaged in the regulation.
Maybe if you can introduce and ask a question.
So my question was, sir, you mentioned that probably there's going to be a reduction in cost of capital for developers going forward. How would you envisage that? Would it be, you know, more from a demand supply scenario, that FDI opens up and there's a lot of demand for smaller assets now that restrictions are lifted, or would it be more from an expectation perspective for a foreign investor, that, you know, he expects more corporate governance to be there, or probably he expects to get more marquee projects which are more infill locations, so maybe his expectations would be lesser. So do you see it going down from higher 20s where it is and probably lower?
So I want to actually qualify that I don't agree with Nishchal and Ruchir on how debt and equity panned out. I'm just qualifying that. we can pick it up over cocktails. But so that said, I think to your question, how the investors view risk and how they sort of price that risk is where the hurdles get set. And some of that is related to sort of just all these gray areas and opaqueness that exists when they come to India. So as you go down, get more sort of transparent, governance starts to go up, I think the cost of capital will anyway come down. Also, we think the RBI position is to bring it down. So yes, for sure, we think that the numbers will come down. I would use an example. We met a Chinese investor who wanted to come in here. I think Chobit met them as well. And their view was that they viewed India as much more risky than China, you know, just because they're going outside. But they also viewed New York City, for example, as much more risky. So they had to go back to their investment committees and answer, why are you taking so much risk in going to the United States and getting such low returns? So the answer is like, it's just as you understand the country more, the assets more, the developers more, you start to gain comfort. I think that capital is does come down.
So I think there are a few people in the next room as well. They are on the screen, and maybe if you can, if anybody has a question before we wrap up, maybe you can introduce yourself and ask a question, because though you have been here, but across the world. Anybody from the next door, anybody has a question? Yeah, if you can ask, introduce yourself and ask. I hope we can hear them, right?
Or maybe you can.
That's easier.
Yeah, you can just open the door and I'll be good.
We can hear you well now.
We can hear you now.
It's an open door policy.
It's an elementary question. I missed the earlier part of the conversation or the earlier part of the deliberations. My name is Manoj Mota from Banyan Resources. The question is elementary. Has the government figured out now that assets which are income generating or income yielding are no longer real estate? And so sorry, I missed the earlier part of the conversation. If this has been discussed, then the question has been
discussed. Yeah, So for certain asset classes, the government has indeed indicated that so long as you're operating and maintaining the asset, it would not qualify as real estate business, and mere earning of lease rental income will not qualify that asset as real estate business, and FDI will be allowed.
Thanks.
It's related to the completed commercial properties. Now, if you can introduce yourself, I'm Jatin Manavre from India Ratings and Research. Question related to completed commercial office property. Now there are a lot of developers who have the completed commercial office property as well as the construction business in the same company. But as an investor, I want to take a call on only commercial property only. Then in that scenario, can a developer transfer these assets because the stamp duty is so high? What is the way to transfer these assets to the media? New subsidiary or a subsidiary which doesn't have any construction activities?
So I think this issue has been going on since 2005, especially for projects which are in an entity. So where there are 10 projects, but the foreign investor wants exposure only on one project. And let's say that project is a slum rehabilitation project where all the approvals are in the name of the project company. And you to transfer those approvals is time issue. At the same time, as you rightly mentioned, stamp duty issues. So we have done in the past some of the deals where we have created tracking stock type of structure where the foreign investment is done in the company, but that investment only tracks the revenues from the project, and the commercials are achieved by issuing different types of instruments to the promoters and to the foreign investor just with respect to that project. So you can do a contractual ring fencing of the liabilities for this project from the other projects. But at the same time, you know, the statutory ring fencing cannot happen because tomorrow, let's say, if there is a tax department wants to attach the assets, they are not going to look at your agreement. They will look at the company as a whole. And in that situation, that risk is there. But yes, some of these deals have happened in the past where tracking stock has been created.
And by the way, now the exit and every FDI conditionality is to be seen on a phase-wise basis.
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to be, so every phase and this language is yet to be clear, but I think the view that people took in press note 10 was that it had to be seen on a sanction plan basis.
Yeah.
So it's on a phase-wise basis that you see your entry, exit, and other conditions.
So maybe we can just take a last question.
Yeah, last question that we can take.
Maybe we can...
if you can... So we can continue or
if there, if there any questions, you could mail it to re1911@nishiddesai.com and we will respond to you.
Yeah, maybe last question.
Maybe last question we can take and then our cocktails we can respond at your own cost.
Certain investment in completed assets, they are out of real estate business.
We already discussed that FDI into real estate LLP is not permitted.
But if it is into operating retail mall in that case?
It doesn't matter.
No.
It doesn't matter.
Because the 3-year lock-in is also applicable to malls.
Yeah.
So maybe
I don't know if there is an appetite to listen to me because I think I'm the head of the organization, all these are the brains of the organization. You heard them very well. But very quickly, let me make a few comments.
Law holds.
Can we put that on you?
Shut down.
Law holds. Between a very hawkish army and KB, a very little way. And Tony.
Yeah.
Sorry for that. And I think 3-4 points I thought I'll just make. First of all, we are talking about, you know, structuring transaction. Now our mindset will have to move to becoming an architect. Okay, because of the DAR, the way in which other things are coming up. So, you know, so far structure is a very structured thinking. Okay. So you think you do not only need a right structure. It's no longer you go on a whiteboard and get a great slide presentation, no longer. It's going to be all about documentation. How do you articulate? Okay. Couple of things on documentation. Every document that you make sure that your recitals are very well written. You must recite a commercial story. You know, many a times you straight away write a couple of sentences and straight go into operational part. It's very important you focus on recitals because if the GAR comes, even if GAR does not come, you know, people would want to know, is this something genuine? What was the background and stuff like that? So storytelling in the recital, which was taken as a normal, you know, standard stuff, but now it really is very, very important. Second point, I would think is that board duties are getting, you know, more and more important. And especially FCPA, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, when foreign investors come, this is a very important point which you must bear in mind. How things may unfold, let me tell you a little bit about that. For example, until recently, you know, you acquired a land through improper means, okay? You have 100 crore property, but you know, cannot disclose 50 crores. Your value is 50. Within 6 months, foreign investor comes and gives you 100 crores. Now, director's duty, what is director's duty? He will have to check what event has happened in between now and within 6 months that property has doubled. Because typically, so far the approach was that, okay, you get the land, you do it, everything, we are not going to be in picture, and now we are going to be, you know, investing, so we don't look what happened in the past. But director's duty is, they need to inquire, did they have an implicit knowledge of what happened and stuff like that, because quietly somebody would always tell, oh, this is what is the cause, how can we do this, etc., etc. So director's duties are getting more and more important to see that it's, you don't turn a blind eye, because then the governance issue will come up, and if anything goes wrong, then more questions and interrogations and the examinations and cross-examination, some of these things come out. Did you have a knowledge of what happened, right? Third thing, of course, we heard chief finance. I think so far we saw most of the investors from the West and from Hong Kong and Singapore. But now we see Japan, China, many other countries are looking at India as an attractive destination. So there is a great opportunity, no doubt about this. But I think more emphasis would have to be on what are our business practices. Now time has come to change the business practices as well. You will soon see Indian companies also going global and mostly getting into real estate as a first. So some point in time, if some of you are interested, we'll have globalization of Indian companies, particularly for the real estate business outside India. I don't know how much interest is that, but we'll be delighted to look at how the things happen in New York or in Palo Alto or in Silicon Valley, or which is bustling, you know, like there also prices are going double at times, and London and many other countries. But this is the trend I'm likely to see, and we are already seeing a number of groups which are interested in going outbound as well, because you diversify your portfolio over a period of time, because you can't have all products in one basket. So Indian companies would also perhaps come to Japan, okay? And the cost of capital, I think so far is cheap, but now next thing is that we would like to take your capital and charge you interest as well. So third thing is that whenever you get into any particular deal, focus more on strategy. There are three dimensions which we call strategy, law and tax. That really gives you a triangular approach. So many a times we are so stuck as lawyers or otherwise law and tax, and we are so dimensional. But really speaking, where we need to focus on tax, on the strategy. If you focus on law and tax and miss out on strategy, I think that is something that you should not. Don't be too cute, as in the words of Ruchir, don't be too cute on law or tax. I think just be a little careful. But strategy really plays an important role. I think this has been a great, I just walked in last minute. I didn't want to talk, but I really want to thank you. But just also want to know, how did you find today's event? Was it good? I think there has been an overwhelming response. We couldn't accommodate people here. We couldn't accommodate in the next room. And also we had to close a lot of registrations. People have been on the call. But I hope this has been helpful. Are you all okay? So can we give a round of applause to all the panelists? Thank you so much.